Today, I'm going to talk to you about the concept of divine intimacy in some Hindu bhakti traditions. The way I'm going to do this is to introduce you to the style of doing theology called philosophical theology, go on to discuss some of the meanings of the term bhakti, and then explore some of the ways in which the concept of divine intimacy turns up in some layers of Hindu devotional poetry. Right, here is one way to introduce what is called philosophical theology. What philosophical theologians are trying to do is to use reason, philosophical reasoning, logical reasoning, to try to bring together human experience and scriptural data in a more or less consistent unity. Talking of logical consistency, let me throw you into the deep end and show you these two quotations from the texts called the Upanishads. The first one seems to be saying that multiplicity or manyness is a good thing. It has somehow emerged from the primordial being, the One. The second one seems to be rejecting manyness, multiplicity. So how does one reconcile this conceptual tension? If you look at the world around you, you see difference. You see dogs and cats and chairs and human beings and tables. And yet the second quotation that I have given you here seems to be negating its reality. Before we go on, this timeline gives you a rough indication of what I mean by scriptural data in this particular context. And we are going to focus, for our purposes here, on the texts called the Upanishads and these systems called Vedanta, which you see here. Now, the Upanishads are often a set of very cryptic statements, and they have been interpreted from diverse scriptural perspectives. Regarding Vedanta, these are a series of philosophical and theological worldviews that try to bring together, systematize the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and give you their essence, the quintessence. Now, Vedanta itself is not one thing. There are at least, say, four or five different systems which are encompassed under that label. Now, here we come to the two most crucial concepts in Hindu philosophical theology, the Atman and Brahman. Here is one way to understand what the Atman is. Suppose I show you a photograph from the time you were a baby, an infant, 3 weeks ago, three weeks old. And I ask you, are you the same person, underline the word person, today, as that baby in that photograph? And let's say you are tempted to say, I am. From an Upanishadic perspective, you are, perhaps unwittingly, reflecting the view that what makes you, you, over time, is the spiritual core, the spiritual essence, called the Atman. Now, from this time onwards, the belief in karma and reincarnation begins to develop in some Hindu traditions. So what makes you you across several lifetimes till you attain liberation or moksha is again the Atman. So Atman is that which guarantees your personal identity. Now regarding Brahman, Brahman is the ultimate spiritual substratum, the ground, the foundation of all reality. It is the still point in a world of change. And here we come to the mother of all questions in Hindu philosophical theology, which is this: what is then the relation between the Atman and Brahman? Various kinds of answers have been tried out, proposed, and formulated. According to some, ultimately there is just one Atman-Brahman. Ultimately, Atman and Brahman are two different entities. Ultimately, it is somehow one in two, somehow two in one. Now, here is one way of trying to understand what is going on here, by focusing on that cryptic statement you see here, thou art that. And you will be surprised by the amount of scriptural commentary that has gone into explicating that tiny verbal form, are or art. Now, there are two ways in which we can approach the infinitive to be, of which the verbal form is. The first one, which you see here, is when I say things like John is an Englishman. Now, what I usually mean when I say things like that is not that being English is all there is to being John. John is also, let's say, a father, maybe an academic, maybe a businessman, maybe a cricket player, and so on. All these different layers are somehow dependent on John, the substance. So the relation of being A, B, C, D, and so on is dependent on John. And according to what I'm here calling Vedanta 1, that is the relationship between the Atman and Brahman. The Atman is dependent on Brahman at every moment for his existence. The second way of understanding the verbal form R is what you see there in the next point. If I say water is H2O, I do not mean that being water is dependent on the molecular structure H2O or vice versa. What I mean to say is that whatever water is really, truly, substantially H2O and vice versa. Now that's Vedanta 2, which we will not discuss on this occasion. We will go on to explore in some greater detail Vedanta 1, and particularly the dimension of bhakti in Vedanta 1. Now bhakti is the devotional love that the Atman, that the individual self, must cultivate, must develop for Brahman, which in this case is Vishnu or Krishna. Now in the next slide, I'll show you Krishna. What we mean by bhakti, the term bhakti itself has a wide semantic range. It can mean to enjoy, to experience, to share, to participate. And Krishna or Vishnu is the ultimate supremely personal God. Krishna is often shown surrounded by the goddess Radha. And in some of these traditions, Krishna and Radha are co-divine. They're equally divine. So I should really say Radha Krishna. And Krishna and Radha, they are surrounded by these cowherd women. You will see in the next slide. They are the gopis. Now I'm going to try to summarize some aspects of these medieval Hindu devotional movements with these three paradoxes which you see on this slide. The first paradox goes like this. The longest way is the road back home. And what that means is if you stay away from home for 6 months and go back home, you will realize it is not the same you who is going back home, and it is not the same home you are going back to. But what if we, all of us, have some kind of a spiritual home, a true destination, our patria, to which we should be headed? Now, according to these bhakti traditions, we do have such a patria, our true spiritual home, which is Krishna. Now, let's move to the second one, which says that the way upwards, the way to God, the way to Krishna, is in fact the way inwards. And the way this works is something like this. Suppose your lover were to ask you, how much do you love me? And if you were to say, my love for you is as high as 8,848 meters, your lover may say, well, that is very cheesy, but I'm not impressed. But what if you were to say this? My love for you is so deep that I am not able to measure the depths of this love. So deeply intertwined you are with my being. You would be speaking a very different kind of language. The point here, the philosophical, theological point here, is that when we speak of love, the metaphor of height, which evokes images of grandeur, of supremacy, of distance, are not as appropriate, existentially appropriate, as the metaphor of depth, which evokes images of intimacy, of interiority, and intensity. So what we are saying here, what these traditions are trying to say, is that Krishna is not on top of Mount Everest. Krishna is not far out there on the other side of the galaxy. Krishna is with you, in you, beside you, in the very interior recesses of the Atman. Now, that is not to say that Krishna is inside you, say 3 centimeters to the left of your heart, we are using a kind of theological metaphor to convey the idea of divine intimacy. And then, here is a third paradox you see here. In some of the more provocative, some of the more theologically provocative strands of the Bhakti traditions, you find the idea that such is the power of love, the power of devotional love or bhakti, that it can bind, it can enslave even Krishna. So if we say that love conquers everything, that everything includes Krishna. Now let's explore in some greater detail this paradox of how the divine Krishna, who is superior to us, who is beyond us, is also with us. And this is what you find in this scriptural text. Let me add some more content to the second paradox. You see here on this slide these two quotations. Again, you see the idea how the divine reality is above you, is beyond you, and simultaneously with you, in you. And this idea is carried over in this particular quotation from the Narada Bhakti Sutras. If you look at some of these points, you get the idea that God is beyond you. If you look at some of the other points, you see them in different colors. They communicate to you the idea that God is with you. And perhaps the most intriguing point here is the last one, which talks about bhakti of the deepest separation. And what this means is that when you feel, when you experience this pain that God has deserted you, God has moved away from you, that unbearable agony that you suffer is said to have the spiritual power to cleanse you, to purify you, and set you on the path to liberation or moksha. And here I'm going to read out to you a poem from this medieval female devotee called Mirabai, roughly from the 16th century, who talks about this bhakti of the deepest separation. The name is gone deep into my mind. Day and night do I chant it. O Lord, I am humble and I am low. How can I sing thy praises? I am engaged in the agony of separation. Right? So the point is that bhakti is not some sort of mere sentimental liking or affection. Bhakti is in a way a terrifying experience. It torments you, it crushes you, it oppresses you, it violates you, and yet through that spiritual violation, you are somehow liberated. And you find this in the same, you find this idea in the next song as well. I am maddened by love, she says. No one knows my pain. Only the wounded know the plight of the wounded. The bed of my lover is in the heavens. How can we be united? Beaten by pain, I wander from door to door. No doctor is to be found. O Mira's Lord, her pain will be erased when the doctor is Krishna. So the idea is that bhakti is a kind of spiritual wound. And the one who has given us that wound, Krishna, is also the medicine man who will give us the spiritual therapy. Friend, I am colored with the love of Krishna, she goes on to say. Others send letters to their lovers who live abroad. But my lover dwells in my heart. Why should I go anywhere? Now I'm going to take you across the centuries and bring you to our own times, to a poet called Rabindranath Tagore. One of his many claims to fame is that he received the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1913. Now what Tagore does is that he takes up some of these motifs, some of these themes, some of these templates, and he reconfigures them, sometimes without mentioning Krishna and Radha. So let's look at the first poem. From where does it strike, this torment of love? Slowly and slowly I think my friend comes. Cast aside all your poverty, light all your lamps, and call out with an eager voice, come my dearest. So here in this poem, who is the friend? It could be pretty much anyone. It could be Krishna, it could be God, it could be your human friend or a human lover. And the theme that human love, bhakti, has the spiritual potency to bind, to enslave even the divine reality is what you find in the next song. Thus is your joy with me, and this is why you have come down to me. And without me, O Lord of the three worlds, your love would have been in vain. So let me allow you to pause for a minute to relish that paradox. Because what we are saying is that the supreme controller of the universe, even Krishna, comes down to us and is bound by our devotional love. So think of a theological scenario where you might imagine or visualize God sitting high up there on the mountains and telling you, "You creature, without me, you would be nothing." And here there is a very different theological scenario where you seem to be saying to God, "Well, look, if it was not for my love, your love would have been futile." So we come back to the theme with which we started, how philosophical theology tries to unite into a more or less consistent whole human experience and scriptural data. And what we've seen on this occasion is how often philosophical theology starts with a mundane experience, such as love, and ends up with a deep paradox. So what is the paradox? It is this, that on the one hand, because we are talking about Vedanta 1 here, we are saying that we are at every moment in time existentially dependent on Krishna, on Brahman, on God, for our very existence. And we are simultaneously affirming that somehow this very Krishna is dependent on us. So which statement is true? This is a theological paradox, and somehow both statements are true. So on this occasion, I leave you to ponder on that paradox.